the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, you know, we've talked about the last few decades that Keynesianism has just sort of been the golden child of academic economists, you know, of course, our Federal Reserve chairmen, you know, right on down the line through the Treasury. But then Japan started saying, you know what, we want to join the party. And, you know, we've talked about Abenomics and how it's really affecting the world right now, but seems like it might be stumbling a little bit.
Today we're going to talk about a couple of things, Kevin. One, certainly Japan and what we see with Abenomics. Certainly we're going to review some of the things relating to pension funds and really the impact that Federal Reserve policies and Keynesianism are having on those pension problems. And I think that's a scenario where we will spend a little bit of time sort of expanding our minds a bit. And lastly, today we'll look at sort of GDP figures, where we're at, where we're going, and some very significant changes that are taking place this week. You know, we had industrial production from Japan, which was announced this week, and it declined the most in June since the earthquake and the nuclear reactor meltdown. So massive decrease in industrial production, not exactly what they were hoping for on the other side of Abenomics and sort of this blitzkrieg, if you will. I guess we're crossing analogies.
And the stock market, the Nikkei, is starting to show disappointment, which that wasn't expected with all this printing that's going on.
But when you apply the market logic of the day, bad news, that is lower industrial production, is causing now a rally in the Nikkei.
Oh.
And again, we've seen a 1,000-point decline in the Nikkei over the last 3-4 days. And then we see a rally in the Nikkei. Is it on good news? No, it's on bad news.
Because they might pump some more money.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the logic used around the world today. The new logic of the day, you get a rally every time you get bad news because the assumption is the Bank of Japan will redouble its effort and the Nikkei will recover more than 200 points as a result of sort of this hyper-Keynesian activity. So if any serious investor is paying attention, Japan is essentially circling the drain. And again, we talk about hyper-Keynesianism. That is just this massive amount of money printing, low interest rates kept at an extraordinarily low level, too low for too long. All that guarantees is that there's going to be more liquidity going down that hole in the floor. Economic health, when you're talking about sustainable growth, it's not created by an easy money policy. You can go from easy to easier, you can go from loose to looser, and all you're going to do is embolden speculators. You're going to allow for greater risk-taking with a lower real cost to those who are taking the risks, and you're layering in instability into the financial system.
Well, David, we certainly have not set a good example on this side of the Pacific Ocean either. I mean, we've been teaching the world that you just print money, you go looser and looser, and of course you do embolden the speculator. Talk about preferential treatment. That's what's happened here in America. We don't have the middle class growing in strength right now. We have the speculators in Wall Street. It's no different in Japan.
If you roll the clock back, the Japanese failed to allow businesses which were deserving sort of the death march, which were deserving to go the way of the dodo bird decades ago. They failed to allow them to fail. And again, you say, well, failure is a bad thing. Mm. Well, if you have a bad business plan, then failure is not a bad thing. It's a natural course. If you want to call it sort of economic Darwinism, it does happen. And it's what Joseph Schumpeter talked about greatly in his explanation of creative destruction. Some things are destroyed so that new things and better things can be created. We don't second guess the Model T or Henry Ford for what he put in place because somehow it destroyed the buggy whip industry. You know, there was an industry that died, and to the degree that we had held that buggy whip industry up and supported it, it would have been to the detriment of a new and better innovation.
Well, you know, you can imagine, too, if they had not convinced the world, and when I say they, the Keynesians again, that deflation is bad. When people are saying, all right, now you never, ever want the price of something to go lower. We have to be able to print money to keep that from occurring. Well, of course, all you're really doing is selling them something that'll kill them in the end, which is hyperinflation.
Yeah, the Japanese lesson, and that's the language used today. There's so much to learn from Japan because of this 20 years deflation. The Japanese lesson that I think people are ignoring is not deflation, and that deflation is bad, and therefore inflationary monetary policies are a cure-all. That, to us, is balderdash. What people are missing is that whenever the state apparatus protects financial and business interests and supports them by giving them subsidies. What you do is you gut the innovative process in the market system, which is constantly looking to improve and grow. And you're essentially doing that because risk-taking is stripped of the reward in the event that success is found. And frankly, those businesses are unable to compete with entities that don't have to be the best in class to succeed. Again, the ones that are getting a subsidy. So the free market system is upended. It's turned over and turned inside out when the state chooses winners and losers. This is the lesson of Japan. Japan has a legacy of corporatism, and no amount of free money will reignite the free market and unleash a revolutionary improvement or set of innovations.
Well, and it's important to understand corporatism, again, is another word for fascism, and we see it in this country as well. Now, you know, our easy money policies don't seem to be really pushing much up anymore either. I mean, the equity market seems to be stalling here on this shore.
Well, we have that. 1,700 on the S&P, 15,500 on the Dow, and we have, in the last several weeks, just sort of stalled out. I think it is this. You have institutional holders who are offloading their shares in mass to the general public, and the general public is buying wholeheartedly what they conceive of as a new and fresh bull market. And basically what you have is flat supply and demand. So when supply and demand are in balance, in other words, institutions and insiders are feeding the general public's appetite, and there's not enough buyers to supersede or press the price higher, but it's in balance today. I think actually we're in a very dangerous place.
Well, and that's not to mention the insider trading that you've been talking about, or the insider selling, which is the corporate bosses who have to report what they're selling. I mean, it's just overwhelming right now. So not only do you have institutional holders that are offloading in mass, but you also still have the institutional selling.
And the place where you find the greatest insider selling, of course, is in the NASDAQ shares. Your NASDAQ 100, it's quite interesting. NASDAQ is hitting new highs for this particular move, and lo and behold, insider selling is off the charts. If you're looking at sort of multiples of the shares bought versus sold, you would have a very different story. And this is not just compensation, people garnering compensation and realizing options. Again, the numbers are far bigger than that.
One of the things you brought out, too, was margin debt. A lot of these buys are on margin, and we had a huge peak in April, but I think it's been dropping off since then, hasn't it?
Fading. And that classic sell in May and go away, I think we'll look and say, in retrospect, actually your speculators did begin to sell in May, and they've been taking money off the table for the last 6 months. By the time we get to mid-fall or even early winter this year, that will be our appraisal. Over the last 6 months, we will have seen the footprints, and I think we already have it now. That margin debt number was 384 in April, now it's 376 in June, and it's steadily declining. The speculative juices are beginning to come out of the markets, and I think this is where we're coming close to a cusp event in the equity market.
Well, and last week, Dave, the failure in Detroit was new information, okay? But since then, we've seen The Economist magazine come out and talk about the rest of the states around the country. And of course, then we have national pension plans to look at. But when you try to stimulate an economy to try to get the growth that we had over the last few decades, and it's just not happening. I mean, these pension funds, they're already underfunded, but they're certainly not getting any gain from the equities market.
Well, and here's the point. It's not just Detroit-centric. It is a far more pervasive issue. Where are the other pensions in the country? Oh, everywhere.
Right.
Every state, every teacher's pension. In every state of the union, you have that. There are the commonly made mistakes of overestimating growth rates on the assets in the pension basket. That's a common mistake.
Right.
But I'll tell you, the universal curse, and actually the universal cure, is far more simple. When interest rates are set below a natural level, income is redistributed, and there's winners and there's losers in that process, and they're selected by someone. And this is, again, back to that notion of corporatism and choosing your winners and losers. Japan did it. We're now in the process of doing it, and actually the Fed is helping promote that by setting rates so low. When you're looking at pension underfunding, you have to consider that 10 years ago, the vast majority of pensions were adequately or close to adequately funded.
Well, Dave, I would hate to be a pension fund manager. I mean, consider the 1% per year gain of the S&P 500 over the last 13 years, and there are no interest rates to speak of.
Well, that goes back to
how do you build anything?
That goes back to that estimated growth rate. You're adequately funded as long as your rate of return on the assets under management are growing at the rate they're supposed to in order to meet their withdrawal expectations in the years ahead. However, if your growth rate fails or slows, if it fails to meet expectations, that's where you're going to end up with not enough money in the pot to pay out as and when it's needed. The other element, though, is this. So you're right. You've got the 1% annual gain in the S&P over the last 13 years. There's also the steeply declining revenues from bonds as a consequence of lowering rates by the Fed.
Yeah.
One loser is the middle class pensioner. And I mean, again, who's the winners and who's the losers? We favored the banking sector and we favored a broad-based recovery, or at least that's the way it's been sold. But in point of fact, you do have the pensioner in the crosshairs, the middle class pensioner. Do you wish to look any further? I suppose you can, but I don't think you have to look any further than the Fed for an explanation of broke and underfunded pensions.
So what you're saying, David, is we just put the blame on the Federal Reserve. What we should probably try to put the solution on the Federal Reserve as well by getting rid of it.
Well, that would be a bigger solution for a lot bigger problems. But at least as it concerns the pension issue, as I said, this is a part of the curse. It's also a part of the cure. Rising rates go a long way towards curing the cash flow requirements of pension managers. Mm-hmm. Cash flows in and then cash flows out to the pensioners. But without adequate inflow, you're left to harvest gains from growing assets. And as we mentioned, the market's just not accommodating that right now. With an average of 1% return over the last 13 years from the S&P, there's simply not enough returns gains to harvest to make up for the lack of money that's coming in from the assets under management. This is the sad truth. The market is blind to individual needs. The market is blind to an individual pensioner who has waited for and is now beginning to collect a pension. The market does what it does, and it does it when it wants to do it. In this case, you've got monetary policy, which is exaggerating the pension crisis. And I don't think the Treasury is actually blind to this, but I think, frankly, their concerns are bigger. They're focused on larger systemic issues.
Okay, but David, all right, not only are they not blind, but I mean, who really benefits the most from cheap rates? I mean, let's face it.
You mean other than Wall Street speculators?
Right.
Well, yeah, because here's the deal. You have well-funded Wall Street speculators. Remember, we're not talking about just individuals anymore, where you may have, you know, a family that's made a fortune speculating in the equities markets. These are sort of the Wall Street tycoons of old, where they started with a very small amount of capital.
And they looked for value.
And they did, but which is essential. Anytime you're investing in the stock market, even if you're buying value, you're still a speculator, because it is a speculative notion that somehow you're finding something that someone else is not finding in terms of value. You turned over a rock that no one had discovered yet. Today, it's not just individuals, Kevin. It is the banks, which are no longer strictly lending institutions. All major banks trade their own investment accounts. See, this is the kind of sick irony. You've got the combination of depositor money and money that they've received from the Fed at the discount window.
Right.
And that is what's driving bank profits today. If you're looking at any of your banks who have been reporting in the last quarter, where have most of them, not all of them, but where have most of them derived their benefits and profits? From trading at their own trade desk. Some of that's fixed income, some of that's equities, some of that's commodities. And here, lo and behold, as we mentioned last week, some of those banks are being put under the microscope for trading in the commodity space. JP Morgan just this week got a $400 million fine.
A little slap on the hand
for a company that makes $99 billion a year. But $400 million was the fine for manipulating the energy market.
Right.
Isn't that interesting that 13 years has passed and Enron goes through hell and back, and they no longer exist because they were manipulating the energy market. But if you're JP Morgan, again, I think it does come back to who do you know, and are you in that sort of Japanese classic chosen few to survive? Whether or not you're adding real economic value or not, it doesn't matter. You have been chosen to survive. And I think largely that is the case with JP Morgan. $400 million fine? Sure. Okay. We have that. That's in the press today. Why? Well, they're not acknowledging or admitting that they manipulated the energy market, but that is what they're paying the fine for.
And they're still getting easy free money. So the fine doesn't hurt that badly because the Fed still infuses them with money. But Dave, if it was just our banks, it would be bad enough. If it was just on our shores, it would be bad enough.
Well, you remember the conversation with Larry Kotlikoff. You know, he wrote the book, Jimmy Stewart is Dead. And what he was basically saying is the old bank is dead. We don't know banking as it once was.
They're now our competition.
They're now sophisticated hedge funds managing money. And guess what? They have an FDIC insurance policy backing them. They also have access to Fed money at basically zero rates.
So they don't take any risk, Dave. They take no risk.
Why do they need you, the depositor, when they can get money for free at the Fed and speculate? And when they lose, they've got the taxpayer to bail them out. On top of that, if there is any bad press, the FDIC steps in like a knight on a white horse and says, don't worry, the depositor's just safe. We're not even dealing with banking institutions.
So it's just
any
like
longer.
Dire Straits, money for nothing and your chicks for free. In this case, it's money for nothing and your risks for free.
Well, ironically, we're not talking about just U.S. banks now either. You know, we've talked about excess reserves held at the Fed. So this is money garnered from the Fed, and then those reserves redeposited with the Fed, and they're earning 25 basis points interest on that money that's not theirs.
They get a little bonus. They get money, and then they get 25 basis points on the free money.
Curiously, 37% of those assets, again, held as excess reserves at the Fed, that are earning interest. That's about $2 billion a year. These are foreign banks with U.S. branches.
Wow.
That have gone to the Fed. They're getting money from the Fed, redepositing with the Fed, collecting 25 basis points a year on money that's not theirs. Is that money staying in our economy? Is the Fed promoting health and well-being in the U.S. domestic banking arena? Or really are we talking about something that should drive the average taxpayer wild? The U.S. government. I mean, again, the taxpayer is usually, and the U.S. government is usually compensated with any excess profits from the Fed. At the end of the year, the excess profits of the Fed get paid back to the U.S. government. That's the tradition. But here we have 25 basis points, which is going to non-domestic banking entities. I'm sorry. This is insane.
So we're fueling the world, basically, or, you know, since we're talking about music, we are the world, not only because we have enough excess money, but Dave, okay, so we've got Wall Street, we've got the banks, we've already talked about their, it's called moral hazard when you bail people out and they don't have any risk, but the real winner in all of this, because the United States government has gone too far, too deep into debt to ever pay it back, and now they can't see interest rates rise because they can't afford the interest.
Well, and that was your question. Who benefits the most from cheap rates? Yeah, so we've got the speculator, Wall Street speculator, and as we've said, it's more the institution today than the individual. It's your bank that's running itself like a highly leveraged hedge fund, you know, but still gets the FDIC imprimatur and those guarantees and whatnot for the safety of a PR campaign. You're right. The big winner here is the Treasury.
Right.
The Treasury receives the biggest benefit, and here's how this works, via a subsidy to its interest costs. When you bring rates down, the interest component on the national debt all of a sudden begins to shrink as well. As the interest rate structure is artificially lowered, the rates the U.S. government pays on its debt, they also go down. Thus, we have the highest levels of debt in U.S. history and a very manageable interest payment each year.
Right, because we have no interest to pay. I mean, let's face it, what is it, 1% or 2%? We can deal with that.
We've been as low as 1.8, if I'm not mistaken, and now we're just over 2, maybe 2.1%. We've averaged $38 billion in interest payments per month over the last 9 months. And at that rate, we'll actually take out the previous highs, and I'm talking about the interest paid on the national debt.
In dollars, yeah. Right.
Previous highs were $454 billion back in 2011, and before that, $451 billion back in 2008, or maybe I've reversed those years. But the last time I had checked the numbers on the Treasury website, they weren't actually that troubling. I was incorrectly assuming that we were at a $225, $275 billion run rate. Actually, you know what? I hadn't been running on the assumption that the Treasury had published those numbers. I was working off of the White House's numbers in terms of their budget, and they were assuming a line item of around $220, $240 billion in terms of the interest expense.
Well, Dave,
we've blown past that, and we're going to be twice that.
Shame on you for using the White House for your statistics. I'm sorry.
I should have learned something. But from that standpoint, we should learn something in terms of using anything we get from the BLS, the BEA, the NBEA.
Or just the general BS. You're right.
You're right. Well, last month, we blew these numbers out of the water. We added $93 billion in the month of June. That's interest for a single month. July, well, this is going to be a totally confusing month, because you've got the Department of Defense, which is doing something with their accounting, and they're going to be allowed to reduce the interest expense by $75 billion for the month of July. I mean, what the heck is that?
Uh-huh.
So the July numbers are going to be skewed in part because of the DOD's one-off reduction in interest expense by $75 billion. But we're on a $38 billion a month run rate in terms of interest payments putting us at 459 for this year, 2013. $459 billion. That's $459 billion interest only. We're not paying back principal here. That's just interest.
David, we've been talking about interest on the debt, but actually the real outlay that we're talking about are things that we can never really recover from or scale back. I mean, you talked about in the fuses lit this year's DVD that Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, they account for 81% of what's coming in right now in revenues. And so we can afford a little bit of interest as long as interest rates stay low, but that's not going to change. The Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security just gets larger.
Right. So these are all sort of tedious numbers. If you're listening and trying to contain all of them in your brain, you might have to listen twice. Again, 81% of current tax receipts, that's a dangerous territory to be in when you're talking about just the mandatory payments of Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security.
And you weren't even counting defense.
No. We left out defense in the film as a major line item, not because we're sort of dismissing it, but because we can cut that to the bone if need be. Whereas there's some political ramifications to cutting Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, which are too great for politicians to ever consider.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to offend, you're probably going to create some job losses, you're going to offend a few very well politically connected people who have government contracts when you start cutting the defense budget. But it can be cut in an emergency, and maybe. There's some flexibility, that's what I'm saying, with defense spending, and it arguably could be reduced to balance a budget. The key point that we were trying to make in The Fuse Is Lit, specifically the segment on An American Reckoning, the key point we wanted to make was that the uncontrolled variable was the interest payments on the national debt.
Right.
And again, just like those mandatory payments, this one's a tough one to sort of get around.
Well, and why don't we put this in perspective, Dave? Sometimes you have to go back and say, okay, where did we start? Where have we come from? Let's just go back to the year 2000.
We could go back 30, 40, 50 years, and people would say, we didn't have Ataris at that point, let alone PlayStation 3s. The world is a radically different and improved place. You can't compare today to that period in time. So yeah, 2000 brings us, I mean, this is still the modern era, if you will. Our economy was in the year 2000 about a $10 trillion economy. $10 trillion economy then, that was our GDP. Our government debt at that point was around $5.6 trillion. Our revenue was pretty decent, $2.15 trillion. Keep in mind, this is the end of the Clinton era. We were running surpluses, not deficits, and revenues were as good as they had been in a long time. Interest on the national debt was around $362 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you compare the interest component to our revenue, the interest component was around 16.8% of our total revenue.
Okay, so now
in the year 2000.
Let's put that into 2013 terms. Let's go fast forward to now and try to compare the two.
So the economy, that's, again, the total GDP figure. We know quarter one showed growth of 1.8%, well below the estimates. We've just had quarter two released in the last week, and it's 0.6, that's 0.6% growth. Very disappointing to all economists, and now they're looking for sort of year-end recovery. We'll get to how they're assuming year-end recovery here in a minute. But 16.33 trillion is roughly where we should finish the year.
In comparison to 10 trillion back in the year 2000.
Yep. And with that in mind, we have total government debt, which is now 17.15 trillion.
Now, let's go ahead and put that in perspective, because that's larger than the GDP, whereas back in the year 2000, our total government debt was 5.6
of GDP. Yeah. And actually, officially, we're still under the debt limit by about $25 billion. If you look at any government website, they'll still say we're in the $16 trillion range in terms of debt, as opposed to 17.15.
Mm.
But this is really interesting. They're pilfering the government retiree benefits to keep up the facade of staying below the debt ceiling.
And that was not happening back in the year 2000.
No. So Reuters reported, you know, Jack Lew said this in May. He started shifting cash flow away from the G fund to pay bills. In other words, they quit funding government retiree pensions in order to pay our bills. And that's how we've stayed under the debt ceiling the last 3 months. And that's why we're not cracking the debt ceiling until we open up that discussion. But until we open up that discussion and that wrangling back on the Hill as to what the debt ceiling, the new debt ceiling will need to be, basically government retiree pensions are not being funded.
So for all you government workers out there who've been looking towards retirement,
oh,
you might
want to
pay attention there. It's a little bit like being in Detroit 10 years ago. Maybe we need to watch what's going inside the pension.
But to my point, 2013, you've got interest payments on the national debt today. We're at that annual run rate of $459 billion. As a percentage of expected revenue, and again, this is using the White House's numbers, roughly $2.7 trillion, you've got about 16.9% of revenues going to the interest component.
Okay, so the most important fact that you're talking about, or let's take the two most important facts, our debt over the last 13 years is triple, Dave, what it was back in the year 2000.
Right, and then the second point is that interest rates have been set artificially low, subsidizing this debt and allowing us to keep our fiscal house in order.
What a sword of Damocles is hanging over our head, though, Dave. I mean, on a thin, thin thread of low interest rates.
Looking forward, they seem to be worrying particularly on the point of unbound interest payments. I mean, again, today we're at 16.9% of revenues being paid out, roughly where we were in the year 2000. Remember, at the end of the Clinton era, we were paying 16.8%. We just looked at those numbers. And that was in a time where revenues were reasonably high, and we were running a surplus, not an annual deficit. So you have to assume that that $17 trillion number is going to be added to next year, and the next year, and the next year. So you do have an increasing burden, even without interest rates on the rise. But today, the tripling of our total debt, the ongoing annual budget deficits, the specter of rising rates, it makes the prospects of financial disaster a real threat. And the bottom line is that if Ben and company walk away, Ben Bernanke, that is, and the Fed, walk away from manipulating the yield curve and setting rates at abnormally low levels, we're likely to see the interest component on the national debt go from that 16.9% number to 25%. 35, even 50% of our revenues. And you say, well, wait a minute. If 81% is going to mandatory payments, we're at about 17% now that is going to the interest component.
Right.
Basic math, I mean, we're already at 97%. We haven't even paid for government operations. That's just interest component and your mandatory payments, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. We haven't even run the government. We only have 2% left. Do you see why I'm concerned?
Well, David, if that wasn't depressing enough, we have 10,000 baby boomers a day launching into retirement. We're just adding to this massive sand pile.
That's why we've been highlighting the issue. I mean, if you haven't viewed the video, The Fuse Is Lit, do so. You can watch it online, request a hard copy.
Yeah, give us a call.
Give us a call. Give a couple hard copies to friends and family members. Something tangible in their hand is often a more effective way for them to remember to do it rather than it being stuck in their inbox as a forwarded message from you. I know the numbers can be a bit mind-numbing, so I'm not going to go into all the details, but there is one other issue I want to talk about today, and it does relate to GDP. And this is sort of a monumental event that's occurring this Wednesday, and I think it's worth discussing.
Well, David, I know what you're talking about. It's an ominous feeling to see it happen again, but each time they stop liking the GDP number, they just go ahead and change it. I think back to 1999 when they started adding things that were expenses and turn them into actual assets.
I think what's really important is people who are educating themselves is to understand that they've got to think outside the box, and they have to see that things are changing all the time. CPI is not counted the way it used to be counted.
Unemployment is not counted
the way it used to be counted. So if you're assuming sort of these fixed things and say, oh, well, the 70s only had this kind of unemployment rate, and today it's so much better. These are the issues. GDP is now a statistic, which is back again. The Commerce Department, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, as a subset to the Commerce Department, is doing a major overhaul of the way they classify components in GDP, and that's happening this week. The last time this was done, you mentioned 1999, that's when software was converted from a company expense to an investment, and thus it created a boost to GDP, categorized as an investment. Again, it goosed the GDP statistic higher.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's going to be a host of new, quote-unquote, investments, which were previously counted as expenses, with, this is so critical, with the net effect being an improvement in GDP by as much as 3%.
Wow, that'll be a nice little boost.
Yes.
And I don't know where it's coming from. But
I'm flabbergasted.
Yeah.
This is really what's scary. All our GDP stats will be adjusted going back to 1929 with many of the previously documented recessions simply disappearing. Because again, if there is a larger economy, things appear to be growing instead of contracting in certain years. Again, the improvement to the GDP statistic is something that will literally cause a softening of all those past blows. You may have remembered recessions in the 70s or in earlier periods in U.S. history. Guess what? In the light of history, they won't be as severe. Why? Well, because we will see in these new components, which were a part of the economy, as it is retold, as it is, again, this is such revisionist history, but because of the improvements discovered and implied retroactively back to that time frame, I kid you not, this week marks a massive revision in economic history.
Well, you know what this reminds me of? If I had to take $5,000 out of the bank to take the family on a cruise, let's say, normally I would have to say, well, that $5,000 came out of the bank. That affects the actual bottom line of my savings. But that added $5,000, it may not show up in the bank account, but
it's no longer an expense. It's an investment.
Wow.
And you know what? If you want to play the semantic game, that's fine. But let's not lose track of reality.
Yeah, but they're doing it with math, Dave. They're not just doing it semantically.
So one of the many absurdities is the new treatment of pensions. I mean, here again is this issue of pensions, pensions, pensions. We've got problems. Well, not anymore. Here's how we're solving one of the many pension issues. I call this an absurdity because I just can't wrap my mind around it. They're going to count pensions as they are accrued rather than when they're paid out, which will do a couple of things. Number one, it will alter the government consumption number positively by about $30 billion in any given year. And then it's going to boost the savings rate for individuals, specifically personal income, the savings rate and personal income, because this is going to be counted as, again, sort of a current income issue. And this is just as pensions are accrued, not as they're paid out. And I'm thinking to myself, what else can you do to sort of fabricate reality?
It's insane, Dave. I mean, if you think about it, they're just adding numbers that really are a subtraction. They're taking it from one column to the other. Like you said, it'll change history. The problem is, for a person who wants to accurately look at these numbers, you have to subscribe to a newsletter like John Williams, or you have to go to an alternative source because there is no real reporting anymore.
And I'm not saying this doesn't make sense to someone. I mean, if you have a PhD in economics, then,
from Princeton, maybe.
Sure. Yeah. Or Berkeley. Then certainly, with your head in the clouds, you can believe this makes sense. But for those of us sort of living in the real world, you say, wait a minute, a pension obligation, someone putting it into a fund, it's not going to the pensioner yet. They haven't gotten that cash flow. It's not going to be spent in the economy. How exactly is that being counted as an improvement to GDP? It makes all the sense in the world that as it's paid out, that you would count it as a part of GDP. But now, as it's accrued, and then you've got the ancillary effect into personal income and the savings rate. These things are mind-boggling. But again, we live in a world today where truth is stranger than fiction.
Well, and truth isn't reported either. Okay, the truth that's reported is stranger than fiction. The truth itself is so hard to come by. I mean, listening to podcasts like this, subscribing to various newsletters, a lot of the people we interview, Dave, they provide the information at great cost to their time and efforts, you know, like John Williams I'm thinking of. If you don't have someone who can actually alert you to those things, what happens is you just open up the paper and you go, wow, there's been a huge increase in personal savings. There's been a huge increase in GDP. It's amazing, and yet it's not an increase. It's just a fabrication.
You have to understand beyond the headlines. I mean, we've passed the transitional phase where individuals were thinking for themselves. Today, we're spoon-fed garbage ideas, garbage data points, which are used to support those ideas. And we're heading towards another transition, and unfortunately a painful one, where individuals awake to the reality of being misled, of being lied to. And I think in that moment, not knowing where to turn, there'll be a lot of social and political confusion. Where do they turn for answers? Where do they turn to for the truth? I think there's also, from a hopeful standpoint, there is the opportunity for us as individuals to have a greater influence and to make a mark, whether it is in our community, whether it is with our family, to provide answers, to provide some degree of sanity and say, you know what, here's how things have changed through time. This is why the inflation of yesteryear is not the inflation that you see reported today. This is why the unemployment statistics of yesteryear are not the unemployment statistics of today. This is why GDP, even though you think you're dealing with constant economic variables, has changed from yesterday to today. And we're talking about this week that this number is being changed. And it brings me back to an issue where if individuals are not thinking for themselves,
right,
they have to. If individuals are not endeavoring to step outside the mainstream of pablum information and frankly deceitful information, they will be at a disadvantage. And as and when we go through periods of major change, I mean, we're talking about social and political change, not just economic and financial change. There will be so many people confused and unable to right themselves, unable to orient themselves. And then there will be that remnant that is able, that is very keenly aware of reality as it is, not as others have proffered it or pretended it should be. And they will be leaders. They will be those who offer guidance, consolation, and an ability to navigate those difficult waters. We are in a period of transition. Again, we've seen the dumbing down of America. We're going to see sort of the blinders removed at some point, and then a mass panic. And that mass panic will have unfortunate ramifications. Those ramifications don't have to engulf us. They don't have to sweep us up with them. There's things that we can do. There's things that we must do to protect our families. And those things I think we've made very clear on this program.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.